From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Okay, let's take a little test. It's multiple choice. You're listening to the traditional English folk song, Greensleeves. Now let me know. Does this song make you feel A, happy? B, like you want to go out and win one for the Kipper? Or sad, C? Well, of course, the answer is C. It makes you feel sad. And it's not just Greensleeves. There are so many songs that make us feel sad. And we love them. We love sad songs. So why? What is it that makes a sad song sad? It's not just the lyrics. There's a language of melancholy inherent in the structure of a sad tune. And first, is this the saddest music ever written? It's Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. It's a composition a lot of music lovers would name as the saddest music ever written. And that includes Thomas Larson, who called his book The Saddest Music Ever Written. And Strange Champs asked, really?
Well, my gosh, it has such a profound and deep sound that I think hearing it for the first time has struck the majority of listeners with something they've never encountered before, and I think that's this sort of sustained sorrow over about 8 or 9 minutes that is rarely found and held in a piece of music. I call it the saddest music because I think the piece's history in American culture has been one of playing it at funerals and memorial services. And I think pound for pound, more tears have been shed with this piece than any other piece in the history of our country. So that's one reason why I call it the saddest.
You know, it wasn't originally written as a funeral piece, but it has over time come to be regarded, as you said, as the quintessential music to play at memorial services. How did that happen?
Barber originally wrote the piece for a string quartet in 1936. He orchestrated it in 1938 for Toscanini. Toscanini premiered it on the radio. And then 5 years later, he recorded it. So when Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in 1945, in April, it was a Thursday, and the radio stations sort of went mute for a moment. They didn't know what to do. This was one of the first media events that sort of required the stations to stop their normal airplay, obviously, and pay tribute to this man who was obviously the center of the country. The war was still going. The Depression had finally ended. So in paying homage to him throughout that day and that weekend, radio engineers reached for plaintive music. And one of the pieces they played, which they so happened to know because of the Toscanini recording, was Barber's Adagio for Strings. And it got played and repeated that weekend, oh, just probably dozens of times. And the music was then stamped with this sort of pedigree that it was funereal in association.
Now, it's been played at lots of other big national memorial services, the memorial service for the Challenger astronauts who were killed, the service for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing, dozens probably of memorial services for the victims of 9/11. It was also used recently in a movie. Oliver Stone used it as part of the score for his movie Platoon, a very different setting. How did the music work in that movie so filled with wartime violence?
Back down there!
Well, the music becomes, as with any good film, really part of the texture of the whole. Scholars call this use of music and image together. They call it a sound image, in which you see an image, you hear music, and you also hear the ambient noise of whatever's going on in the scene. And in Platoon, the adagio just saturates the film along with the sort of the story of the fighting against the Viet Cong, but more importantly, within the platoon itself. And then you also get this other layer of the helicopters and the gunships and the arguments and the men screaming and the bombs going off and the radio dispatches. It's just an incredibly layered film. And the adagio does this service of, in a sense, boldly contrasting some of the film images. It sounds like the film is actually grieving the war as we're watching film clips of the war itself.
What's so curious about this is that Barber wrote what has become one of the saddest pieces of music ever written at what must have been a very happy time during his life. He was 26 years old. He was in love. He was vacationing in Europe with the love of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the sadness come from?
Where did the sadness come from? It's a great conundrum. You know, a poet friend of mine once told me that the thing about artists is not so much they need to be in a state of feeling, but they need to have, in order to produce good work, but they need to have access to feeling. He said, interestingly, that he understood that what had probably happened to Barber was that he reached a state of contentment. And he could access that deep emotion that was in him. He was a melancholic and very serious guy. But it took a kind of a contentment, a balance, a stability in his life for him to be able to go there. In other words, I think it's a myth that artists have to be wildly happy in order to write wildly happy music. Certainly we know stories about Beethoven and composition of some of his greatest pieces, which he wrote counterintuitively. You know, times when he was in the deepest despair, he also produced some very joyful music, such as the Ninth Symphony.
How does the piece work? What is it that Barber did as a composer to make the adagio so expressive of grief and sorrow?
Someone once commented on the adagio that it sounds like a piece of music that could have been written in any of the previous five centuries. And what that basically means is that it sounds kind of medieval in spots because it uses a kind of a chant, the repetition of a chant-like melody, which repeats itself in full three times. And yet there is a kind of romantic sound to the inner voices between the strings. Of course, with the orchestra, you have five different levels of string players. There's also the harmony is, I think of as modern because it is very lush. It's not a harmony that anyone, Brahms might have used those kinds of harmonies, but no one before Brahms. But then it has this sort of unresolved quality to it that Barber amplifies in the piece. So it often sounds to people, and I think this is its treasured aspect, it sounds so primal to the species. It sounds like something we could have been singing listening to in a monastery in the 14th century, as well as it works so beautifully in a contemporary choral concert, for instance.
And it kind of, as you said, it doesn't resolve. There's a way in which it leaves you suspended in this kind of long period, present period of mourning.
Yes, it reaches this remarkable climax about three-fourths of the way through. There is this big, loud, screaming chord, triple fortissimo for a very dirge-like and quiet piece. It just sort of explodes. It stops. There's 6 seconds of silence, of course, which is the loudest moment in it. And then it starts up again, and this fourth time through, it just sounds and almost feels exhausted with itself. And Barber, it's sort of, He's trying to find a way out of the piece. Before he ends it, he sort of starts it up again, but it doesn't quite get going, and it has this kind of four-note benedictory conclusion, which doesn't conclude. He sustains a single emotion, call it a kind of a passionate melancholy, over 8 minutes that very few composers either try to do or have the guts to do, because the movement, of course, just sort of dies of its own exhaustion, and we're sort of glad for it. It can't go on any longer, and yet it holds us in that emotion long enough for us, I think, to feel the depth of grief.
Thomas Larson is the author of The Saddest Music Ever Written, The Story of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. While we were putting this show together, we pored over lists of sad rock and roll songs. There are a lot of them. Right up there on most people's lists? Yesterday by the Beatles. Tears in Heaven by Eric Clapton. Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. But there was one song that topped almost every list we found. Everybody Hurts by R.E.M.
When your day is long and the night is yours alone, when you're sure you've had enough of this life,
what about you? What do you think is the saddest rock song ever? You can email us at ttbook.org or go to our Facebook page where you can see what everyone else has to say as well. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
In Western music, if you want to be happy, just play something in a major key. Think, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. And if you want to be sad, head to the minor key. Luli lulay, my little tiny child. Well, it's nothing new to anyone who's ever had their heart broken, is it? But a recent study at Tufts University's Music Cognition Lab suggests that the minor third doesn't just convey sadness in music, it does so in speech as well. Steve Paulson sat down with the study's co-author, psychologist Megan Curtis.
First, can you remind us what the minor third in music is?
It's, do you want me to sing it for you?
Sure.
With that?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
It's just a combination of two pitches at a specific frequency ratio. And it sounds very sad. It's highly associated with sadness in music.
Mm-hmm. And why is it called the minor third?
That's just the musical terminology. Every musical interval has a different name. So there's a slightly happier musical interval that is just slightly larger than the minor third, which is called the major third, which is
Well, we actually have some examples of not just the minor third, but something else as well. Let's hear these, what we brought in on a CD.
So that interval is called the minor second, and it's used in music to communicate negative emotions. That's actually the interval that you hear in the Jaws theme, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's strongly associated with negative emotions. And in my research, I've actually found that it's used to communicate negative emotions in speech as well. We see that interval in the use of, it's used in the communication of anger, and it's also used to a lesser extent in the communication of sadness in speech.
Wow, so that's fascinating. So you really do see a link then between music and the spoken word.
Particularly in the communication of negative emotions. Not so much in the communication of positive emotions, at least not that my data has revealed.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have another example as well. Let's hear the next one.
So this is called the musical minor third, and in Western music, it's strongly associated with sadness. And in my research, I've found that it's actually used fairly often in the communication of sadness in speech. So there really does seem to be a link between how sadness is communicated in music and how it's communicated in speech.
I want to come back to the speech in just a moment. But so do we hear this often in music? I mean, is this a sort of a common theme that you'll hear in a lot of different songs or instrumental pieces?
Absolutely. This is actually one of the characteristics that helps us discern sad music from happy music. This is a salient characteristic of the minor mode. And most Western music that we hear as being sad is actually written in the Western minor mode. So this minor third is actually a very salient property of music in the minor mode.
Okay. Now, you have also been doing research looking at the connection between the spoken minor third and the musical minor third. Let's hear an example of the way this can be said.
Let's go.
So what do you take away from that when you hear that?
Well, it's the same interval that we use in the communication of sadness in music. So to me, that says that there is a deep link between music and language and how the two domains communicate emotion.
So how do you go about researching this? I mean, particularly finding this connection between language and music.
Well, we know that in music, the pattern of sequential pitches plays a really important role in communicating emotion, and that specific pitch patterns are associated with specific emotions. So we know that in speech, pitch patterns also communicate emotion, but the knowledge base in that research is just not as specific. Until my recent study looking at this issue, we really didn't know which pitch patterns were important for communicating emotions in speech. So to examine this, my collaborator, Jamcha Barucha, and I decided to investigate whether people use specific pitch patterns in speech to communicate specific emotions, much in the same way that they do in music. And we found that they actually did. We had actresses record short phrases with different emotions, and they said very simple things like, let's go, come here, and okay. And they said them in a few different emotional states, communicating anger, happiness, pleasantness, and sadness. And then we ran acoustic analyses on the speech samples to identify a representative fundamental frequency for each pitch in the speech sample. And we assessed the pattern of pitches within each speech sample according to a musical scale of measurement so that we could compare the pitch contours that are emotionally meaningful in music to those that were used in our speech data. And we found that there were correspondences.
Fascinating. So do you think this is true, the way when people are talking, when they are sad? I mean, do they sort of naturally lapse into this minor third way of speaking?
There seems to be a tendency to do so, yes.
Let's go.
Okay.
Come here.
You know, when you're talking about sadness as it's associated with a minor third, it makes me wonder if it really matters what is being said. I mean, if I said, I love you in the minor third, would that be perceived as sad?
I think that it could be. I think that someone might say, I love you in the minor third if you're about to leave them, perhaps.
So watch out. Now, is this only true in English, or does the influence of the minor third on language cross other languages and cultures?
That's a fantastic question, and I don't know the answer to that yet. My study looked at speakers of American English, and currently, to the best of my knowledge, no one has looked at other cultures to determine whether there are cross-cultural correspondences. I have plans to look at speakers of Hindi to see if they're using this same type of interval pattern, which would be interesting because their musical system is very different than Western music. So if we find a cross-cultural correspondence, then that would speak to the notion of whether this is culturally learned or whether there might be a hint of universality in the use of these types of pitch patterns.
Now, to step back for a moment, do you know why music and speech share some of the same patterns when expressing emotions?
There's this question between music cognition and psycholinguistics regarding whether music evolved from language or whether language evolved from music, or perhaps whether both domains evolved from a common ancestor.
What would that mean? What would that mean if language evolved from music? You're suggesting that people might have sung before they started saying words?
It's entirely possible. It's hard to reconstruct the evolutionary history. But I think that data like this that shows correspondences across the two domains can lead us perhaps on the right path or lead us to asking questions that are going to put us on the path of discovery towards maybe understanding the evolutionary origins a little bit better. I don't know if we'll ever really know the evolutionary origins, but I think that any correspondences that are noted across the two domains suggest that there is some sort of link between the two domains evolutionarily, and perhaps that they both evolved from a common ancestor. Particularly, I think that my data support this theory that they may have evolved from a common ancestor simply because we explicitly use these types of pitch relationships in music, whereas in language, our use of them is much more implicit, which to me suggests that they may represent a type of evolutionary vestige from perhaps an earlier system for communicating emotion that is not used with quite as much consistency in language, but is used with stunning consistency in music.
I wonder if it would be possible to even look at the way non-human primates vocalize, whether there would be any link to some of these emotions in their pitch patterns, chimpanzees or gorillas, for instance.
I've heard some really interesting vocalizations from macaque monkeys who, when they're presented with a type of food that they really don't like, they make a vocalization that to me sounds very much like a descending minor third, which is the same thing I'm finding in the sad speech samples. And when they are presented with food that they really like, they vocalize with a pitch contour that goes up in pitch, and it's certainly not a minor third. It's more along the lines of an octave. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of work to be done looking at vocalizations in other species as well, particularly species that make pitched sounds that are similar in that regard to the types of vocalizations that humans make.
Psychologist Megan Curtis talking with Steve Paulson about a study by the Tufts University Music Cognition Lab. If you're a music lover, you know some of the most brilliant sad music ever written. It comes from jazz. Think of Frank Sinatra's version of In the Wee Hours of the Morning. Or, of course, Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday. Or this from the legendary Chet Baker.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do.
What do you think is the saddest jazz song ever? You can email us at ttbook.org or just go to our Facebook page where you can see what everybody else has to say as well. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, so here's a joke. What happens when you play country music backwards? Your wife returns to you, your dog comes back to life, and you get out of prison. Well, country music is sad. So sad we didn't know which songs to include in this hour. So Steve Paulson called Bill Malone. He is America's foremost historian of country music, and he has a thing or two to say about sad country songs.
Now, of course, sad songs pop up in every kind of music, but there is something about country music that seems to bring out the melancholy and the despair. Why is that?
I don't. You know, that's a question I used to get all the time when I would sing at parties. My preference was for sad songs, and I'd sing them. He said, "Why is country music so sad? Why don't you know any happy songs?" And of course, the answer is there are all kinds of songs, not just those, but people do love the sad songs. And I think it's because it's been a working class music. It was made by poor people, struggling people, folks who had known the pains of early death, and, you know, with large families and a lot of children who passed on, and old people who grew up and didn't get the same sort of care that they receive today in society. So I think it was a hard life, and it was reflected in the music.
And it was a hard life both for the performers, because they tended to come from those circumstances, and for the audience.
Yeah, Hank Williams said, you know, in order to be able to sing a country song effectively, you had to have smelt a lot of mule manure out in the field, walking behind them a long, hard, hot, sweaty day. So he felt, and a lot of people felt this, that you really need to have felt, to have experienced the life in order to experience the emotions that went with it.
Well, you have brought in some of your favorite sad songs, and you just mentioned Hank Williams. I know you brought in a Hank Williams song. Tell me about this one.
Yeah, this is a real daunting task that was set for me, because there are so many sad songs in country music. But this particular one I chose has been around a long time. I think it started out as a poem in about 1895 or 1896. And it was recorded in the mid-1920s, when country music was just getting started. And it's endured over the years. I've heard it all my life. And it was a kind of a hard choice to decide whose version to use. But I think that Hank does it maybe the way it was originally designed. It sets out some of the grim aspects of life without any hope for resolution.
And the title of the song?
Pictures from Life's Other Side.
It's a picture from life's other side. The first scene is that of a gambler who had lost all of his money at play. Drew his dead mother's ring from his finger. Yes, the one she wore on her wedding day. His last earthly treasure, he stakes it, and he bows his head, his shame he might hide. Then when they lifted his head, they found he was dead. another picture from life's other side.
When you hear that song and you hear Hank Williams doing it, do you feel like that his own pain comes out in that song?
Yeah, that was part of his genius, I think, his ability to speak directly to the listener. You know, when you heard Hank sing, you thought he was singing directly to you. He meant every word he said.
Now, another one of the songs you brought in even hits closer to home because you're on it. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is a song called Will the Angels Have a Sweetheart. It's a true story, so they say. It was written by a fellow named Walter Bells, a member of the Bells Brothers singing group for many years on the Grand Ole Opry and elsewhere. And it's his memories of an incident near his home in West Virginia. A little boy named Buddy was at the bedside of his sweetheart, Betty, and knowing that she was dying, but yet hoping for a reconciliation in heaven. And I think we like it in the first place because it's about children. You know, we're suckers for anything that happens in the lives of kids. But in this case, I think it also touches a nerve in all of us. We'd like to think that there is reconciliation with our loved ones. We have a sort of mixed feeling toward it. We have that desire, but on the other hand, we feel, well, it's probably not going to happen. So anyway, it just tears it at the heart. This is Rod Moog and me doing Will the Angels Have a Sweetheart.
Dying in a home so lonely was a little girl one day, sitting closer by her bedside was a boy about her. Side by side, in her ear these words she whispered as she slowly, slowly died. Will the angels have a sweetheart up on heaven's golden shore?
Find it comforting to hear such a sad song like that?
I do, yeah. All my life I've liked songs like that. There was a large slice of the traditional country music audience that liked those songs too. I don't know much about the taste of the current country crop. You know, I frankly don't listen to the current.
I like the older
classics. Stuff, yeah.
Now you have also brought in a song by Dolly Parton. And you are a great admirer of Dolly Parton, aren't you?
Yeah, I think one of the great strengths of Dolly is her songwriting. We know her from her singing, and we know her through her personality. She has a larger-than-life personality that she likes to portray. She's a master at packaging, you know. Mm-hmm. But what's often overlooked in the glitter and glamour that she possesses is her ability at writing songs. You know, and just in the short space of 3 or 4 minutes, she can really encompass the aspects of life and the thinking of average people.
So what is the song that you brought in by Dolly
Parton?
This
one is called Down from Dover, and it's about an unwed mother, loved too strongly but not wisely. And she went into labor thinking that her lover is going to show up any minute, as he promised he would. But, of course, he never comes. So what the song reminds us is that for every unwed mother, there's also an unwed father. And it's just about the failed dreams of this young woman who, to the very end, and to in fact to the death of her child, is still harboring the illusion that he's going to show up. He's going to show her the love that he promised.
This dress I'm wearing doesn't hide the secret I have tried concealing. When he left, he promised me that he'd be back by the time it was revealing. The sun behind a cloud just cast a crawling shadow o'er the fields of
just a picture from life's other side.
Yeah. Now, do you think these songs would still be sad without the lyrics? Is there something inherent in the tunes themselves that makes them sad?
I think in each case, the songs that we played today, I think there's strong fusion of melody and words. I think sometimes in country music, particularly in bluegrass music, the sad emotions are sort of stripped from song by the instrumentation. You know, bluegrass musicians tend to play songs really fast. Mm-hmm. I like to think of them as being heartbreak at superhuman speed, you know.
I've never heard bluegrass described that way. That's a good way to put it.
But there are songs that are sad just because of their arrangements and the tunes, the melodies they have. But I think today, the ones we've heard, you have to have the lyrics to really appreciate the poignancy.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play one more song. And actually, this is the youngest performer you've chosen, Iris DeMint. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this song.
Yeah, Iris grew up in California, but she grew up in a family that had roots in the Ozarks, people that lived in northern Arkansas and Missouri. And like so many people, they went to California to find a new life. But she grew up hearing their music. She was reared in a Pentecostal family, and with hearing her mother and father sing the old songs, particularly those of the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers. You know, there's another ingredient we can add. It's the way the songs are sung. Mm-hmm. Not just the lyrics and the melody, but I doubt that Iris could do a happy song very well. You know, she has such a searing, emotional voice that she invests every song with great feeling. There's no mistaking when you hear her. You know it's Iris DeMint. This is a song about a loveless marriage. Some young woman someplace. It's set in rural Idaho, I guess not too far from Coeur d'Alene, but it could be rural Wisconsin or rural Texas or a small town life anywhere in America. And it just brings out those universal feelings that so many of us have had of having to deal with an experience that's just not as happy as we'd like for it to be. This particular one is called Eases Getting Harder Every Day.
Standing barefoot on a cold wood floor, looking out the window of my back door. If it keeps on raining, I think the whole damn house is gonna float away. The alarm was buzzing at the break of dawn. My husband's asking, is the coffee on? And easy's getting harder every day. I'll drop the baby off.
You know, this makes me wonder what life would be like without these sad songs. What do you think?
Well, for one thing, we'd have a dramatically incomplete picture of what life is really like. You know, if we had only these happy escapist songs, although these are escapists too, but if we had only happy songs, we'd have just a tiny portrait of what life is like. And so I think these are little snapshots of the varying experiences that people have, the frustrations, the failed dreams, the heartbreak of death and parting. And I think it just reminds us of who we are. We hear these songs, we hear ourselves. This could happen to us and very likely has happened to us in one way or another.
And there's something about hearing the music. I mean, mm-hmm. the words themselves can be sad, but it's when it's combined, when it's turned into song, mm-hmm. that's when it takes us to some deeper level.
Yeah, that sets music apart from poetry. You know, sometimes people just refer to a song as being a poem, but it's more than that. It has that melody that you're talking about and that general feeling. And altogether, it just creates a mood for us and a way of understanding that you can't get from anything else.
Bill Malone is America's foremost historian of country music. His book, Country Music USA, is considered the Bible of country music. Steve Paulson spoke with him. We're talking about sad music this hour. I don't know about you, but personally I find the cello to be the saddest instrument. In fact, it's a truism in rock music industry. If you want to make a sad song, put a cello in it. But that's now. What about then? That's Pablo Casals recording in 1936, the opening of Bach's cello suites. Written in 1720, Bach's cello suites were almost lost to obscurity until a young Casals in the late 1800s brought them back. I sat down with Eric Siblin, author of The Cello Suites, to find out more about the fascinating story of how Pablo Casals resurrected Bach's cello.
It was 1890. Casals was a 13-year-old boy who was studying in Barcelona. He was playing nights in a café trio in order to pay for his education. And on one weekend, his father had come up from the nearby village of El Vendrell in Catalonia, Spain, visiting Pablo, and they were strolling around looking for sheet music that young Pablo might use for his burgeoning career as a café musician. And it was then that he literally accidented upon this old edition of the cello suites, and it immediately galvanized him. He was blown away by the fact that this music existed in the first place. The immortal Johann Sebastian Bach had written music for his instrument, for cello, and for cello alone. So he purchased the score, and immediately one imagines he was trying to decode it, and the music was coming alive in his imagination, and he cradled this this sheet music, took it home as if it were a treasure, and started to methodically figure it out, something that had not been done with any success since perhaps 1720 when it was composed. Casals waited a good 12 years before summoning the courage to start performing these suites in public. And that was quite a revolutionary thing for any cellist to do. This happened at the very dawn of the 20th century, around 1901. And that marks the sort of the public rehabilitation and resurrection, if you like, of the cello suites.
What's fascinating in a way is that up until this point, they should not have been widely recognized. We think of Bach as the major composer of his time. I know there's a lot of argument about that. But here we are at the turn of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, and essentially no one has heard these things almost since Bach wrote them.
In fact, the answer to that question has a lot to do with the career of Bach. Although Bach is now up there in the pantheon with Mozart and Beethoven for us, and as you mentioned, it's inconceivable for us to imagine a time when Bach was not famous. In fact, there was a time when he was not famous in his own lifetime. Bach was very well known in his town. Leipzig was where he spent the last 27 years of his life. But beyond that, he was not a superstar composer. And that's largely explained by the fact that Bach was not a composer for opera. He never lived in a city that supported an opera house. And opera was really the road to major fame in the 18th century. So Bach, by and large, was not famous in his lifetime, and it took a long time for his music to get back into circulation.
You hear some of these things in the music. The way you describe it in The Cello Suites, the book that you've written, is pretty clear. His falling for his first wife, Barbara, Maria Barbara. His falling, like, as you say, a ton of medieval masonry for Anna Magdalena Bach. In fact, you've structured the book around the sections of the music, but it's the preludes that seem to have captured your attention. What is it you said, that each of the preludes is the essence of the story?
I very quickly found myself looking at this music as if it were a story and a series of stories. Each of the suites have their own quite unique personality, and I think you sense that most compellingly in the prelude of each suite, which very much feels like an exercise in storytelling. It also has a very loose improvisational quality, the preludes of each suite. It's hard not to get a sense of a journey, I think, when you listen to the preludes. However relaxed and loose they may begin, They very much embark upon a journey with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
This first prelude, the one in the first suite, it is the thing that brings you to a desire to hear all of the other six. What would you say about that very first prelude of the first suite?
It sounds very much like a string player warming up at the very beginning. It also has a sense of a journey, something almost wave-like. I think there's a sense of waves running through this. And for me, I always think back to a 13-year-old cellist, Pablo Casal, stumbling upon this music in a secondhand shop in Barcelona in 1890. Now, of course, Bach didn't write that into the first cello suite, but I think he did write a sense of youthfulness and optimism and a sort of leisurely, serendipitous milling about in an improvisational sense.
Part of the thing that's interesting about this is that this is, after all, a solo instrument we're talking about, one that has four strings attached to a box. And we're talking about it, though, as though the music comes alive in the hands. And that's all Bach. I mean, yes, of course, the performer, but he had to put this music into a form, and it's so limited in what he's available to him that it's astonishing what he was able to accomplish with it.
Yes, I think that that's one of the themes of this music, is that how much Bach accomplishes with so little. It's really exquisite minimalism, and he bursts the boundaries, I think, of what the cello can accomplish and what a melody instrument can accomplish. He insinuates all sorts of things. He plants seeds of successive ideas, and there's a lot going on, even though you've got four strings and one bow. There's no question that Bach is taking the cello to sort of incredible and unprecedented heights, both technically and emotionally. For me, it's very hard not to listen to, for example, the second cello suite and not get a sense of tragedy. It really begins with these three notes that are really quite dark and ominous. And when you match that up against when it was likely written and what was going on in Bach's career, it's hard not to think that, in fact, this has something to do with the death of Bach's first wife, Maria Barbara. Suite number three, by contrast, kicks off on such an upbeat, effervescent note. It's, in fact, a downward scale, a kind of a tumbling into love, that, again, it's hard for me not to see Bach falling in love for Anna Magdalena. Suite number four has got a real sense of struggle, and it actually contains a very exotic, nearly Near Eastern sort of flourish. And suite number five, again, conveys a tremendous sense of mystery with a dramatic curtain raising and a sense that something really ominous is about to happen. And that takes us finally to suite number six, where the prelude I'm speaking of is transcendent. It really bursts the bounds of everything that's come before. And in fact, for suite number six, Bach is using a five-stringed instrument, not even a four-stringed instrument, perhaps not even a cello. And this is one of, I think, many mysteries that surrounds this music. What was that instrument? And how transcendent Bach gets by the time he's at suite number six.
Eric, you had a fairly successful career as a critic of pop music. How did you move from that to a fascination with Bach's cello suites?
Well, I didn't wake up in the morning and decide to discover Bach or to discover anything. It was really quite by happenstance. I found myself in Toronto one evening, staying at a hotel with nothing to do, and I scanned the listings of a local newspaper and saw that the cello suites by one Johann Sebastian Bach were being performed just across the street at a venue not far away. And for reasons that still escape me, I took a chance on that music. It was not something I was in the habit of doing at all. The result really was life-changing for me. I was immediately swept away by what I heard, And I think more to the point, I was intrigued by what I learned about the music. The program notes pointed to several mysteries in the music. The fact that Bach's original manuscript disappeared sometime after his death in 1750, the fact that the music was unheard of in a popular sense until a 13-year-old cellist by the name of Pablo Casals stumbled upon them in 1890 in Barcelona while out for a walk with his father. The fact that Suite Number 6 was written for a mysterious five-stringed instrument, Suite Number 5 was written for the lute as well as the cello and dedicated to a mysterious Monsieur Schuster about whom nothing was known. All of this taken together led me to think that there not only was his music more earthy and ecstatic than anything I'd really ever heard before, but that there was a story there somewhere in the music. And when I left the concert hall that evening, I think I had this very strong suspicion that there was a story there I wanted to pursue.
Eric Siblin is the author of The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and The Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. All of the music we heard was recorded by Pablo Casals in 1936 and 37.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park, and then later, when it gets dark, we go home.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Why Do We Love Sad Songs? Program number 1212B. I'm glad I spent it with you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.